The world's animals, plants, and critical habitats are disappearing at alarming rates.
It is a revolution of how we live in this planet.
Environmentalists from hundreds of countries are meeting this week to find ways to reverse the trend.
It's a really big ask, but it's that question of, we keep on unraveling that sweater and we end up with basically a life support system that goes down the tubes that none of us are going to find a habitable planet.
A look at what it means for the planet and our own species.
Today is Tuesday, October 22nd, and this is The Issue from VOA.
I'm Scott Walterman.
Hi, Scott. And I'm Lori London. And thanks for being with us.
Protecting, conserving, and restoring nature is not only a task of environment ministers and alike. It is actually a mobilization.
Along with the climate crisis, the world is also facing a biodiversity crisis. The UN Climate Program says the world is experiencing the largest loss of life since the dinosaurs. 1 million plant and animal species are now threatened with extinction.
This week, environmentalists and leaders from nearly 200 countries are meeting in the Colombian city of Cali for the UN Biodiversity Summit, known as COP16, looking to agree on ways to save nature from the current rate of destruction. Olivia Zolino with Reuters outlines for us what they hope to achieve.
At COP15 2 years ago, countries agreed on more than 24 global goals. The agreement was called the Kunming-Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework. It includes things like setting aside 30% of the Earth for conservation and mobilizing $200 billion in nature financing. Host country Colombia has put the inclusion of indigenous and traditional communities at the center of its agenda. The UN Office for the Conservation on Biodiversity has called for special protections for indigenous groups in voluntary isolation, stressing these communities' role in protecting nature. COP16 will look to finalize a new program, including traditional knowledge in national conservation plans and decisions. Wealthy nations previously agreed to contribute at least $20 billion annually, starting in 2025. The money would help developing countries meet their nature goals. So far, biodiversity aid has fallen short of those levels. Both governments and companies are expected to announce further funding efforts at COP16.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino.
You know, Lori, it's hard enough to get people to pay attention to the climate crisis. This is a little bit more obscure and a little bit more complicated. It's going to be just that much harder to get people to pay attention to this.
I don't know, Scott. When I hear about all of these animals, the numbers dwindling, I mean, someone who loves animals, I mean, when I think of a world without elephants, it pains me. Or, you know, what about the coral reefs and, you know, things like that. I think that actually, you know, people, it's more tangible.
I think it's more relatable. Anyway. Yeah.
I do kind of. Yeah.
Well, it is an issue that will impact life on Earth for all species, including our own. Joining us now to dig into the issue itself and the goals those attending are hoping to achieve is Tanya Sanarib, International Legal Director with the Center for Biological Diversity.
Thank you very, very much for taking the time to speak with us. The conference is going on. I know you have some of your folks there in Colombia. And basically, the bigger picture is that the world is experiencing this massive decline in wildlife, habitat, species. And that's really something that is an astronomical thing to be addressing. Let's just start with this really serious warning just a couple weeks ago from the World Wildlife Fund, 73% decline in wildlife populations monitored from the past 50 years. Why is this happening and how serious is this situation?
The situation is incredibly serious. And I think that those of us who work on biodiversity conservation really are struggling to catch up with where the climate movement is in terms of raising awareness about these issues and just how potentially catastrophic it really is. I think that the WWF report was a really good wake-up call, and it's a really good metric to try to shake people into action and make them aware of what's actually happening in the natural world. In terms of why is this happening, there's a lot of different drivers of the biodiversity crisis, but the two primary ones, according to IPBES, when they did their assessment of where things stand in terms of the extinction crisis, the leading drivers are habitat loss and exploitation. And I think one of the things we've seen from the Convention on Biological Diversity, from the framework that was agreed to at the last COP, is a real focus on habitat loss and how do we combat that. And that's where we have the 30 by 30 call for action. But I think where, in terms of the framework agreement, where things are really lagging behind is also that need to address overexploitation of species and to address the extinctions and the significant loss, as you said, that was just highlighted by WWF.
How do you move the needle with the public? We talk about this a lot on this show and the other shows that we do here, and so do other people. But how do you reach the average person on the planet, make them understand the significance of what's happening?
Yeah, and I think that has been a real challenge because, as with the climate crisis, the biodiversity crisis is really hard to wrap your head around. And like the climate crisis, we don't have, one metric, right, that's, 1.5 degrees or bust. And I think that that's been a very big problem for the biodiversity crisis in terms of, what are our marching orders? What's the one top level ask that we have? But that said, I do think we have a major advantage when it comes to biodiversity because we have these phenomenal stories that can be told. And so people care a lot about wildlife and species. And so you can, for example, talk about the fact that if we save forest elephants in the Congo Basin in Africa, they are gardeners of really critical rainforest ecosystems that we need to be able to mitigate the effects of climate change, but that also harbor a tremendous amount of biodiversity that are really crucially important to be able to protect. And so you can use a species like an elephant, which a lot of people love and adore, and take that animal as sort of an example of if we can protect and recover forest elephants, we can save these really important ecosystems. That means protecting a whole lot of other biodiversity, and it means combating the climate crisis at the same time. So we have the opportunity to be able to tell those stories. And I think the question is just, can you, when you're looking at this huge, gigantic crisis that we're trying to address, can you break it down to something that people can actually wrap their head around?
Would you say that a lot of this is that what has happened is based on humans' actions and human activity, and at the same time, it will be felt deeply by humans and nature around the world?
Absolutely. That is 100% correct. It is our use of habitats. So whether we are taking, natural ecosystems and converting them to use them for agriculture or to create, places for people to live, to graze livestock, you name it, that has profound implications for biodiversity. At the same time, as populations grow and we take over more of those natural ecosystems, we're also consuming more of the natural wildlife, we're exploiting them. And so you have more people going into more natural areas, extracting more resources, whether that is trees, whether that is medicinal plants, whether that is wildlife, whether it's wildlife to be eaten or to be turned into commodities and sold. And all of that has really profound consequences for biodiversity. At the same time, you have what we're doing to our climate. And that is what's really lurking in the background here. We have these key drivers that are happening right now that are contributing to the loss of biodiversity at these alarming rates. And you have looming, the climate crisis and the fact that at some point that will subsume those direct things that people are doing, the habitat loss, the exploitation of species, application of pesticides, things like that, introduction of non-native species. And so, yes, it is absolutely people that are causing these problems. But at the same time, we have this tremendous opportunity, sort of looking ahead to 2030, what can we do over the course of the next 6 years to be able to address this? And I think that that's why all eyes are on Cali right now, is to see what can be done, what kind of forward progress is going to happen, because that window is closing to be able to address these direct human cause drivers of biodiversity loss in a time frame that's going to matter and make a difference.
If we do not get on top of this and it continues to run away at the rate it is, what does the world look like in 10 years?
You know, I try to think of ways to describe this that people can understand. And I think, you know, some of the scientific literature uses this idea of unraveling the natural world. And so you start to think about, oh, if, you know, you have a sweater and you just have a thread that's loose and you start pulling on it, it doesn't seem like it's that big of a deal, right? You know, you get that little inch hole or whatever, and you're like, oh, that's not that big of a deal. But if you keep on pulling and pulling, eventually you unravel that whole sweater. And I think that that is one of the best analogies I've seen for, you know, what we need to be doing in the next decade. We need to stop where we're at and start rebuilding and restoring the natural world, or we're going to just end up without that sweater. And that sweater really is the life systems of our planet. And that means, you know, places where we can grow food, where we can have water, where we can have all the ecosystem services that biodiversity provides for us, that I think most of us don't realize how critically important those are.
And I know the convention that's happening now is also focused heavily on indigenous communities. Tell us a little bit about why that matters and what role they play.
Absolutely. And I think it is a really key part of the framework agreement for this decade, is that recognition that Indigenous peoples have been some of the best protectors of biodiversity. They have a different relationship oftentimes than the predominant sort of Western culture does with biodiversity. And I think that's really crucial when you think about how we use habitat and how we exploit natural resources, and making sure that we have protections and metrics and things in place that will actually guarantee the long-term, not just survivability of those species and those ecosystems, but that they thrive. And so there's a recognition more that people perhaps are a part of that rather than they are separate from nature and are looking at ways of exploiting it. And I think that was a really important mind shift in the framework agreement. And I think the question now is, how do you put the rubber on the road, right? We're dealing with implementation of that framework. Countries are preparing their national plans. How are they going to protect biodiversity to meet these targets? And what role do Indigenous people play in that? And it raises a lot of really interesting and really important questions. And I think it's going to be very fascinating as those plans start to come out. And we only have 25 countries that have developed their plans. There's still 170 to come, which means that we're already behind where we're supposed to be, because those plans were supposed to be submitted for this COP, this meeting. But I think it'll be very interesting to see how open-minded governments are in terms of really taking the role that Indigenous peoples have with regard to biodiversity and incorporating that into how they address biodiversity loss at the national level.
In that regard, what would you like to see them walk out of COP16 with this time? What's the actionable goal?
I think one of the crucial things that needs to come out of this meeting, to be totally honest, is closing the financing gap. And there's been a huge discussion and a lot of debate at CBD about, do we continue to use the previous structures and institutions, or do we recognize that this is a crucial moment in time? We need something new to be able to get the ambition, to be able to fund the ambition that we all recognize is needed to be able to address the current crisis. And I think, as much as it's horrible to say it, you know, I think where financing comes out at the end of this meeting is really going to be a make it or break it for how ambitious countries are going to be in addressing the biodiversity crisis.
So these agreements We've heard a lot about these sorts of things with the climate conference and this and other things. There's no real legal binding to them, though, correct?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And, you know, I think this is another instance where in biodiversity, we have a lot to learn from climate, because there's been such tremendous work done in the climate context to talk about national contributions and who needs to be financing what. And we're really behind the ball when it comes to biodiversity. But at the same time, you can have that public naming and shaming and recognition that, yes, there are absolutely countries that have consumed way more of the natural world than others, and they need to be leading in terms of financing. You're right that, you know, by and large, a lot of the Convention on Biological Diversity is, you know, agreements that countries make, and a lot of it isn't enforceable. There isn't a compliance mechanism, whether it's for not contributing your share or for not accomplishing your biodiversity plan. But I also think that a lot of the countries that are party to the agreement think it's incredibly important, and they're very embarrassed when they don't meet their commitments, whether that is commitments for biodiversity or commitments for the resources that they're supposed to put into things. But really, to get at the closing the financing gap, we're talking about $700 billion, and that means a drastic change globally in terms of how we think about biodiversity and how we finance the work to be able to protect it and to restore it. And that's getting rid of harmful subsidies, and then it's drastically changing how a lot of things around the world work. And that is pretty significant, and it's a major commitment. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how that discussion plays out in Cali.
You know, it sounds like politics. So when you say getting rid of subsidies, you're talking about politicians stepping up and doing something their constituencies aren't going to like. It's a really big ask.
It's a really big ask, but it's that question of, do we suffer a little pain now because we have some changes in terms of the loss of subsidizing things that are harmful to biodiversity, or do we keep on unraveling that sweater and we end up with basically a life support system that goes down the tubes that none of us are going to find a habitable planet? And I think that answer should be a very easy one. It's just a question of the scope that people want to look at the problem at.
Tanya, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this.
Well, thank you both so much for covering this, and it was great speaking with you.
Tanya Sanarib, International Legal Director with the Center for Biological Diversity.
So, you know, Scott, as we've been hearing, a lot of this situation is driven primarily by humans and the human food system, you know, related to the threat of wildlife plowing all that land. I keep telling you, try stop eating meat, and you don't listen to me.
So just to let you in on this, Lori has been hounding me to cut down on meat consumption.
Well, I am vegan, and I am caring deeply about animals and the planet. I mean, Scott, why don't you just try to just like have like one day a week where it's like a meatless Monday or something like that. Meatless Mondays. Can you just not eat a burger on Mondays? Just no meat.
Sure. Maybe.
What? Are you for real? I mean,
yeah,
are you saying this now because other people are listening? Oh, you're kidding. I didn't. That's what I thought. All right. Well, I'll keep working on it. I will keep working on it. We'll get back with you on this.
We'll keep you up to date. We'll see if we'll let you know if she wears me down.
All right. Well, this has been The Issue from the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks so much for joining us.
You can follow The Issue on X and Facebook at VOA The Issue. And for news 24/7 on our website at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Lori London. We'll see you tomorrow.